House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:35 on February 19th, and today with us we have Bob Heron, Representative Andy Josephson, Representative Laura Reinbold, Representative Dan Sadler, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're having our first overview on the, hopefully, the new gas line. It's our intent. We started a little bit early. We are the second committee of referral on it, but not knowing what kind of time frame we have in the first committee, we're going to run our overviews now so the committee will be up to speed when the bill does come to us, and save everybody a fair amount of time because we're down to 90 days. And let the record reflect we've been joined by Speaker Chenault. And with that, Joe, who's going first? You or the commissioner?
We'd like to vote.
Or both?
Vote.
Perfect.
Commissioner and commissioner.
Commissioner
and
commissioner.
What is that?
And for the time being, I think we'll do this informal. If somebody has questions, midstream, raise a hand, and we'll take them as we come to them, hopefully, and we'll see if that works, and if it does, we'll keep doing it that way. But thank you for joining us today, and please state your names and affiliations for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. We have prepared a slide deck for the committee today that hopefully will help orient you to the different documents that you'll see over the course of the committee hearings. What we have here is three main documents: the heads of agreement, the memorandum of understanding, and then the legislation itself. And the legislation itself contains three big pieces and parts: the three P's, the participation, the percentage of participation, and the process for developing contracts that would come back for legislative approval. And in order to help legislators understand what it is we intend to do with the authorities embodied in House Bill 277, we refer back then to the heads of agreement and the memorandum of understanding that informs not only the legislature but the public as to what it is we're going to do and how we're going to do it. So in the second week of January, Commissioner Rodell and myself both signed on to the heads of agreement, a document that describes the roadmap that all of the project sponsors are going to follow to develop the necessary contracts that will govern the project as a whole. It describes some very key principles and understandings between and among the parties. And then there's a memorandum of understanding that lays out the manner in which the state is going to partner with TransCanada on the midstream elements of the project. There are some very key commercial terms that are in the state's interest, and we'll be able to go into those in greater detail here a little further in the deck. What's really important for everybody to understand is you can see on this particular slide there is a stoplight on the far right, and while we've signed the heads of agreement, we've signed the MOU, all of that is dependent, all of the actions described in those agreements are dependent upon passage of enabling legislation. If it doesn't pass, we can't do many of the things that are described in these underlying guidance documents. So they all fit together and work together as a package.
Representative, Commissioner Bailey, I should like the record to reflect we've been joined by Bob Heron as well. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, so what is a heads of agreement? We're going to try and walk you through each of these documents with the exception of the legislation since it's not properly before the committee, but we'll talk about specifically the heads of agreement and later the MOU. And And this heads of agreement is signed by all of the parties you can see on the right, the administration of the state of Alaska represented by DOR and DNR, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, TransCanada Alaska Development, ExxonMobil Alaska Production, ConocoPhillips Alaska Inc., BP Exploration Alaska Inc. And this agreement is for the Alaska LNG project. Ultimately, we captured this this definition from Investopedia, and I just want to give a tip of the cap to Lisa Diemer, one of the reporters at the Daily News who found this and included it in one of her stories. But a heads of agreement is a non-binding document outlining the main issues relevant to a tentative partnership agreement. So I don't need to read the rest for the committee, but it really is something that is a statement of intent. It describes for, again, legislators and the public, how it is we intend to work together going forward. The agreement itself is organized into 13 articles. There's a set of recitals that walk us through the bit of history behind this agreement in particular. And then there's a couple of appendices and exhibits that are also relevant. The exhibits at the end include a series of correspondence from the companies involved to the governor over the course of the last few years and helps provide some additional context that complements the recitals and some of the language in the agreement itself. The appendix is one that deals with the pro-expansion principles that are really a fundamental piece to this overall understanding. There's some
Bale, I hate to do it to you again, but we've also been joined by our last member, Representative Millett, and we do have a full committee.
Excellent, Mr. Chairman. And please, feel free to interrupt me anytime. So some key recitals in this agreement. There's a number of them laid out, and it, as I mentioned before, helps lay out some of the history. But in particular, we have language here that recognizes it was changed circumstances in the lower 48 natural gas markets that led the governor to call on the parties to call for a change in direction under the AGIA framework and direct the parties' efforts to focus on an LNG project targeting Pacific markets rather than the lower 48. Another recital recognizes that funding from the state under that AGIA license has supported key activities related to this LNG project, and that both the administration and TC believe it's appropriate to transition away from the AGIA license to focus on the Alaska LNG project. Thirdly, and this is something that I'm sure the speaker would echo, is that we recognize AGDC is pursuing the ASAP project, and that the AK LNG project and ASAP intend to cooperate with one another. But for now, ASAP remains unfettered, unobstructed, and on schedule. Fourth, and this is a key part that we'll get to in Article 4, but the LNG parties wish to ramp up their pre-FEED activities in that phase of the project, and that's expected to cost somewhere north of $400 million all in, and that is something that is a key aspect of how the project is going to be progressed, and that's through a phased approach. There's a definition section in the agreement calling out a few key ones here. As I mentioned at the top, enabling legislation. None of this can happen if Commissioner Rodell and I do not have certain authority to negotiate contracts with the other sponsor parties. The MOU references a separate agreement between Commissioner Rodell and myself along with TransCanada. Then pre-FEED is the phase of project development that we're currently in. And that stands for pre-front-end engineering and design work that will inform the very big decision of entering the FEED phase, which in itself will take 2 to 3 years and cost upwards of $1.5 billion, maybe $2 billion. It would generate the information necessary to make a complete application at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has exclusive jurisdiction on liquefaction terminals and plants. RIK is a reference to royalty in kind, we'll talk about more fully. And TAG, a new term, tax as gas, is going to be the Department of Revenue's share of the gas production that is a key part of this project. There are some additional articles that follow. There are some key principles that we thought deserve their own article for recognition here. And the first and foremost is that all of the parties, including the two represented here at the table, recognize and respect the authority of this branch of government, and that we need enabling legislation if we're to proceed in the fashion contemplated here. Article 3 calls out the specific benefits of an Alaska LNG project. These are the things that we all hold dear to our heart: getting gas to Alaskans, jobs for Alaskans, revenue to our state, and opportunities for additional development. A piece of infrastructure as big as what's contemplated here has the potential to facilitate an expansion of exploration activity on the North Slope that we've not had in the past. Currently, and for the last 40 years, a discovery on the North Slope that included methane really wasn't thought very much of. There's not much you can do with that gas if you find it. And so when considering the success chance of an exploration well, companies evaluate the likelihood that they're going to find oil or gas. And for the last 40 years, finding gas was not part of the success case. Finding oil was the only way to be successful on the North Slope. If the infrastructure is in place and companies now have an opportunity to monetize gas that they find, well, now the number of circumstances under which you can call an exploration well a success is going to increase, and that's going to give us more positive decisions to put holes in the ground on the North Slope. And really, for all of the benefits of 3D seismic and the latest innovations in some of the non-invasive exploration techniques that are out there, it still all comes down to whether you put that hole in the ground and are able to test what you think you see in the seismic data. And we need those holes in the ground. That's what's going to lead to further production for our state and our future.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Balash, relative to the key recital, the second one that you've summarized here, I guess I'm puzzled by comments made by legislators. And I don't mean puzzled in the sense that, well, I have respect for them and their intelligence, so that's where the puzzlement comes from. But the comments I'm referring to have been about the treble damages fear. I'm not a contract lawyer. I just took it in school. But it seems to me so obvious, and I'm as certain as I could be, that when TransCanada itself, in the summarized recital 2, says, yes, we're waiving this previous statute and any right and entitlement we have, and we're moving forward on something new, I think in the contract law they call that a novation. It's taking a previous agreement and putting something on top of it that becomes the new agreement. And so I'm just, am I missing something here? Is there any colorable argument that if the enabling statute is passed, there's no legal repercussion I can identify?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we have worked very hard to make sure that nothing we are doing nor asking the legislature to do in any way would expose the state to any further liability or treble damages under 4390. It is something that we would be happy to put the Department of Law in touch with either your office directly or here in the committee to explain some of the rationale. But as it's been explained to me, part of the reason that we are not in jeopardy is because TransCanada is part of the project being contemplated here. The key elements of that project assurances clause in the AGIA statute was that the state would not grant some benefit, some inducement to a competing project. Well, how can you be a competing project if the licensee is a part of it? So there's that
Joe,
aspect of
it. Can you speak closer
it.
To the microphone, please?
I'm sorry about that. Sure. I'll try not to swallow it. How's that? So that's one aspect to all of this in the overall arrangement. There are any number of other considerations that come into play. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I think is also relevant is in the MOU itself, which I think Commissioner Rodell will speak to. You know, there's a very clear delineation between the parties that we are stepping away from that license and leaving it behind.
So, thank you.
I have a question.
Rep. Sam Lett.
Good afternoon, Deputy Commissioner. So, on that point, you're stepping away from the agreement, the AGIA agreement. But you're not terminating it.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, no, we are utilizing the abandonment provisions in the AGIA statute, so it will be left behind. But we don't have anything else to step into yet. We don't have the authorities granted in the enabling legislation to become a part of the AKLNG project. So we need the enabling legislation to pass, the agreements for the that are contemplated under the HOA to be formed, and then both TransCanada and ourselves will step out of the AGIA license and leave it behind.
So will you be terminating the license of AGIA legally?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that's correct. We will be. If the enabling legislation passes, yes. We currently are operating under a Project Plan Amendment 1B that allows some of the pre-planning activities to go on during the first and second quarter here, the beginning of the second quarter. But it's expected to terminate, and we will be done other than having to finalize the last of the accounting for the reimbursements and buttoning things up.
So, may I follow up?
Follow up.
So, if this project doesn't go through and ASAP goes through, is that still considered a termination of the agreement of AGIA?
Through the chair, Representative Millett. The MOU lays out what we will do if the enabling legislation passes. It does not say what we would do if it does not. So exactly what will happen in May, I can't predict.
So possibly there could be treble damages if this legislation doesn't pass.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I hate to in any way speak for the folks at AGDC, but they have gone out of their way to ensure that they have not done anything to cross that line and expose the state to damage, and so I don't see that happening.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner Designee, just a quick clarification. I want to make sure I get on the record that this is not really, it would not be a mutual funding that a GIA project is uneconomic. It would be a mutual abandonment conditioned on passage of the enabling legislation. And I want to get to what's the actual process for finding economic, what's the standard. So is it an actual finding of uneconomic, or is it a mutual abandonment?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the process that's laid out in the statute in 4390, I believe it's 240, allows either party to raise their hand and say, I think this project is uneconomic, mm-hmm. and then there's a choice on the other party's part. They can either agree or they can disagree and send us to arbitration. In essence, what we've agreed to is the mutual agreement path that the project licensed under AGEA, the Alberta project, is uneconomic. We've agreed to agree.
Okay. But there is no objective standard for what is uneconomic. It doesn't fail to meet a certain return on investment. It just says, bing, I get off here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the statute itself has some references to what one would consider in that arbitration if we had a contested situation, but it's not specified to sufficient detail that you can hold fast to whether it is or isn't. And there's enough ambiguity in the statute that I think either side could probably employ some lawyers.
So there's, again, there's no objective standard. You can just claim it, and it's basically stipulated that, okay, we'll let you claim it's uneconomic.
That is an option available under the statute, yes. So.
Yes, I recall, I think we tried to clarify that a year or two ago, didn't we? So we wouldn't quite be in this position, but.
So Article 4 is the project work that's contemplated by the parties. And it's here that we start to talk about this staged approach, and the particular stage and phase of the project we're entering is the pre-FEED stage. That's expected to last somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 to 24 months, and that information that's gathered in that period will include additional environmental data, baseline data, technical information. There'll be some engineering work completed to refine the cost estimates that will allow all of the parties to then evaluate whether or not we have a project or sufficient possibility that we have a project that would warrant spending the really big dollars in FEED. During this phase, there's going to be specific project services agreements for the state's gas that need to be entered into, one with TransCanada and one with AGDC or AGDC subsidiary to carry the state's interest in the liquefaction plant. And that's looking downstream. The overall contemplation here is that the state is going to have a share of the gas and a proportionate share of the project infrastructure represented by our production tax and royalty interests. So as we look downstream at the GTP pipeline and liquefaction terminals, and we enter into these project service agreements with those two entities, we also need to look upstream to the producers. And what we'll be seeking there are offtake agreements and balancing agreements. And this is a pretty important part of the overall package, because in order for the state to be comfortable in taking on the obligations associated with these midstream service agreements, we're going to need to know that we're actually going to have gas and that we're going to have the right amount of gas. And that's where these offtake and balancing agreements come in. The companies who have the leases, who are the working interest owners and the producers of the gas are the ones that we're going to need to look to get our share of the gas. And because we have varying royalty rates between Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, the exact timing, which we can't know today and won't even know in this pre-feed phase, of which field's going to come on first and in what amount, could cause the state to be a little bit high or a little bit low in terms of its share of the gas being produced from that field. In the long run, we're going to have about a 75-25 mix between Prudhoe and Point Thompson. And there's a commercial solution to all this, and that's called a balancing agreement. Balancing agreements are utilized in industry as a routine matter, and it's a way to smooth out some of these otherwise uneven aspects of production that occur.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. So I just have another question. I'm not an attorney like my friend over there is, but under the Memorandum of Understanding under 8, the language in it seems to indicate that the state becomes part of the licensee. So we gave TransCanada the exclusive right to the license, but we're going to enter into a relationship between the state and the group, and the license will be owned jointly by the state and by the producers and by TransCanada. Am I mistaken there, or is that?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, if you're referring to paragraph 8 in the MOU,
mm-hmm.
then what that's referring to is the Project Plan Amendment 1B that I referenced mm-hmm. previously. And that's a continuation, basically, through the end of the first quarter here, maybe part of the second quarter. In order for the licensee to operate under the terms of the license, to be qualified or entitled to reimbursement, they have to have a work plan and budget that Commissioner Modell and I have approved. So PPA 1B was a work plan and budget, essentially an associated schedule that covers this period of time.
So who is the current licensee?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, the same parties that were approved by the legislature in 2008, and that's TransCanada, Alaska, and Foothills.
Thank you.
The last item here, key activity number 4, is one that actually is one of the more significant ones included in the document. And that's where the parties, all of the parties, state and producer parties, commit to initiating their preliminary marketing efforts for LNG. And, you know, over the last bit of tortured history we've had in this state in considering North Slope gas for commercialization, there have been a number of parties or individuals who've sought to go out and sell our LNG to Pacific markets. Problem was, those parties didn't have the gas to sell, and so it didn't work out in the end. In this case, we would have all three of the producers and the state of Alaska initiating the marketing efforts that are so critical to the success of a project like this. The heart of an LNG project is the SPA, the sales and purchase agreements. Very long-term agreements between the producers of the gas, the manufacturers of the LNG, and the buyers of that LNG. And those long-term contracts between those parties are what everything else rests on, the financing, the investment, and this is, we think, a very key and important step in signaling that this project is real and means to do business with the buyers of LNG in the Asian markets. Article 5 calls out the findings and determinations that Commissioner Rodell and I have made with regard to the benefits of state participation, and that in order to maximize the state's value and opportunity here, that participation is done under the terms contemplated here, the principles contemplated in this larger agreement, really is in the state's interest in a way to advance the project going forward. It highlights the specific benefits that we expect the public to realize, and calls out that we will participate in the infrastructure as an equity holder of gas, but entering into partnerships with both TransCanada and AGDC or AGDC subsidiary to carry our interest in that infrastructure. As line agencies, DOR, DNR aren't exactly equipped to be corporate players, infrastructure players in the traditional sense, and so relying on a proxy like AGDC or TC, an agent actually, not a proxy, is the way we think this is going to work going forward. And finally, the state's interest, the state's share, we have agreed with the companies, the other companies, that so long as the production tax gets set in a manner that when combined with our royalty interest totals a number somewhere between 20% and 25% of the gas, that we're ready to move forward. And so the legislation that was introduced by the governor pegs things at a little more than 22%. Basically, what this provision is stating that, so long as the numbers don't come out too low or too high, we're ready to move forward. There's a number of things that the bodies are going to need to consider in where to set that number. One of those considerations is going to be the state's debt capacity, which Commissioner Rodell can talk about. Another is where the where that number puts us in the order of things relative to the other parties. Basically, who has the biggest share of the gas and who has the biggest say in what happens in the project?
Representative Reinbold. Representative Heron.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. Just so it's on the record, on key provision number 3, could there be, it doesn't have to be immediately, but could you describe where that, say it's 22.5, but if we were to go to 22.7, that would be a tipping point where we wouldn't want? I just want, for the record, I just want that sort of explanation.
Through the Chair, Representative Heron, that's an excellent question, because as we examined the principles here and the fundamental thing that we were seeking to achieve was an alignment of interest between ourselves and the other parties, as well as aligning our interest in the gas with our interest in the infrastructure. And there is a point at which that gets to be too big, and there's a point at which it's too small, that the opportunity to realize real revenues for the state in the long run relative to the risks that we might be undertaking as a participant in the project, going much lower than 20 is probably a big problem. And, that's from our perspective. Going over 25 gets to be a problem for some of the other parties, but I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say it might be a problem for us too in terms of what we can afford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Article 6 is a really important one. This goes to the overall framework, the regulatory framework, and the key access and expansion principles. And one of the things here that we wanted to ensure is that we're going to have multiple offtake points so that Alaskans can get gas off of the project, but also potentially get gas into the project. And I think of the exploration activities underway by Doyon in the Nanana Basin. If they find a tremendous amount of gas, they're going to need to be able to get that to market. So being able to get gas into the pipe is in some ways almost as important as getting gas out of the pipe at these offtake points. the work that AGDC is doing and undertaking in their open season will inform us as to where some of the demand points are and where to locate these offtake points. That's going to help us tremendously. Number three, though, is really the key to the overarching structure here, and that is each party who has a share of the gas is going to hold their capacity in the infrastructure in the same basic percentage. And they're going to operate their share of that infrastructure on a proprietary basis. One of the reasons that we've had so many fights over the years on TAPS has to do with the manner in which tariffs are structured. That, you know, we all know how much TAPS costs, something like $8 billion. The question in terms of figuring out the tariff is, well, how is that $8 billion financed? And what does that mean to the tariff, ultimately? And, you know, one of our wisest governors, Governor Egan, wanted the state to own its share of TAPS before it was constructed. And, you know, he managed to convince the state house of that and fell a vote short in the Senate. So we didn't own our share of TAPS, and as a result, we have fought with, and sometimes viciously so, with the owners of TAPS over those tariffs. And the reason that we've fought was because that tariff impacts our royalty value and our production tax value. And in order to move past some of those fights in the past, in this particular provision, each party is going to be operating its own share and financing its own share of the infrastructure so that it really is none of our business and has no impact on our business if one of the other parties decides to go at a very high equity level or to earn a very high return on that equity. In the conventional structure, that would impact us in ways that are very material, and we would care. In this approach, we're basically seeking a live and let live arrangement, where they set up their business as they see fit, and we do likewise. So, finally, we call out that the portion of the project that would be owned by our agents, AGDC and TransCanada, that capacity would be committed to provide access to third parties on terms that are developed with the state. And so these are the key parts of Article 6. And before I move to Article 7, I want to jump to Appendix A, because Appendix A amplifies some of the things that are really important about this overall framework. And Appendix A lays out the principles under which expansions may occur on the project. And the really important point here is that in A11, it's called out, everybody agrees, that any of the Alaska LNG parties may initiate the process for an expansion of any component of the project, whether that's the GTP, the pipeline, or the marine terminal. Now, there's a carve-out for the trains, the liquefaction trains, and that's an important thing. But if you see in the highlighted text there at the bottom, assuming there are no negative impacts on the other parties, then that expansion that was initiated can proceed. In essence, what we have is a sole risk, keep whole approach to expansions here, where if the state is interested in an expansion occurring in the pipeline, as long as it doesn't impact the other three parties, then the other three parties can't say no. And that expansion will occur, and additional volumes will flow, and we will benefit from that additional production of gas, and hopefully it'll be from state land. So returning back to the articles.
Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The Commissioner Designee Balash, sections A3 and A2 of the Appendix A, could you put in layman's terms what the principles are for modification or expansion of the LNG liquefaction plant? Whose volition, who's responsible, who pays?
Sure. The expansion principles differentiate between the liquefaction trains themselves and everything else. And basically our principle is any part of the project, with the exception of the trains, can be expanded on this sole risk basis that I just described. When it comes to the trains, however, we have to handle those differently. They are the most sensitive part of the total package of infrastructure, and if there's going to be any modification to the original trains, that's something that everybody has to agree to. Now, and so that is described here in, I believe, A2. A3, however, says that, well, if a modification of the original trains either isn't possible or isn't agreed to by the other parties, then somebody who wants additional liquefaction capacity can get it by building a new train. So the project itself is being designed around the concept of three liquefaction trains down at the marine terminal. And so there will be a certain amount of capacity available through those three trains. If there is sufficient additional gas discovered that can commit to capacity in the pipe, the GTP if necessary, and can fill up a new liquefaction train, then a new train can be added at the marine terminal site. So still working with those same basic principles that if one party wants to add a train, the other parties can participate in that new train, but they don't have to. They don't bear any risk associated with the installation of that new train.
Paula. So again, it's not a rheostat. You can't dry out the train. It's either all on or all off. So if someone finds gas in a Nana or someplace else in the slope, say Alaska AGDC, wants to send gas down, it's going to require liquefaction services. They can do it by themselves if the other parties do not agree. Or they can all do it together if they all agree. If they don't all agree and the one party wants to do the expansion, it's at their cost. They have to pay whatever X billions of dollars to put in a new train. If they don't have enough customers, can they then turn on cell capacity? Once they've made the individual election to build additional LNG liquefaction capacity, can they later turn around and sell capacity to others after the fact?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's an excellent question. And basically, he who owns the infrastructure owns the capacity. And there will be a need to be sensitive to the other parties in the operating agreements that ensure we're not in any way causing harm or problems. But in essence, yes. If somebody were to want to take the risk of building an entire train, even if they don't necessarily have enough gas for that train, and they were willing to speculate on the opportunity to sell that capacity later on to somebody else, you know, that's a business proposition.
I'm sure there are different terms and conditions and deals you can make before you make the commitment versus afterwards, so got to love that market. So.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Balash, I'm trying to conceptualize if the number of molecules in the line, if a quarter of those are the states taken as royalty and tax to then market as we see fit, we could invite expansion of our 25% to third parties that are other than the parties of the initial agreement. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, and that is correct.
And if I could, what I'm trying to get a sense of is, does our 25% expand to 30%, making 105%? I mean, I'm trying to visualize how much, or alternatively, do we surrender 5% of our room and give it to an independent? I'm trying to get a mental picture of this.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you're going down a very interesting line of questions, and what it has to do with is how the capital costs and or operating costs will be reallocated among the parties, and that is something that is going to require very careful crafting of the operating agreements in this next phase of development. Those kind of details are definitely going to have to be worked out, because you're right, it doesn't just become a 105% project. There is going to be a reallocation or recalculation of whose equity interests amount to what in the overall agreement. So understanding those things is going to be very important in this next phase.
Paul?
Well, just the
new line?
No, same line. when I think of compression, I think of some sort of technology that is beyond my pay grade that puts more molecules into the same amount of space in the pipeline. That, am I right about that? That that's what's happening?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you're correct.
Okay. All right. I think magic is what we're bringing. Yes, thank you.
Okay. So, continuing on Article 7, and I'll try to speed things up a little bit here, Mr. Chairman. It's the end of the day. So Article 7 is describing the enabling legislation. And, you know, it's interesting. I think if you ask the other parties, they'll tell you that this was a little bit of a leap of faith for them. We had the language that appears in the heads of agreement itself, but they didn't see the legislation until it was read across the floor in each body. So there needed to be sufficient explanation in the agreement for them to be comfortable to sign on to this agreement. But as far as the actual drafting and specific language that was put together, that fell to our agencies and the Department of Law. The timing that is contemplated here is that hopefully by April the legislature passes the enabling legislation, and that over the next 12 to 18 months the administration and the other parties will develop all of the contracts that are necessary to advance into the FEED phase. And so as we develop those projects, we will be keeping the legislature informed. There, you'll see when we get to the legislation that there are provisions that allow us to brief committees during that development process. But it would be then in 2015 that the legislature would consider these project enabling contracts and hopefully approve them. And hopefully all of the parties then are ready to advance into the FEED stage of development in sometime late in 2015 or early 2016. Royalties and production taxes in Article 8. The combination of those two interests add up to what is referred to in the contract and the agreement as the state's gas share. Our royalties at Puto are generally 12.5%. We have a few that have some added features like sliding scales and net profit shares. Point Thompson, however, generally is a little bit higher. And when you blend them together in the ratios contemplated for the project, our state royalty interest is a little more than 13%. When you add production tax to that, and we're asking for a gross determination for that particular tax measure, that in combination those two would add up to a number that is somewhere between 20% and 25%. And and in order to facilitate all of this, there is the management of that gas, responsibility of that gas, and ultimately the marketing of it. And under our leases, we have the right to take our gas in kind or in value. And one of the things that was actually a bit of a surprise to me when I learned of it a couple of years ago, and this was back in 2011, is that the statutes actually direct us to take our oil and gas in kind, unless we determine that taking it in value would be in the best interest of the state. So that's where we start in this conversation, is that we're going to take our gas in kind. As members of this committee might be familiar, in 2013, the Department of Natural Resources undertook an extensive study through its contractor, Black & Veatch, to identify the risks and opportunities associated with managing our royalty, including what might happen if we were to take it in kind. And we found that there were a number of risks that the state potentially could be exposed to. Many of those risks are ameliorated or mitigated if we have an interest in the infrastructure. But the biggest risk by far is that we, because of our inexperience in marketing LNG, because of the need to establish an organization to do that, we are likely to suffer a discount in the pricing of our LNG if we try to do this on our own. And recognizing that risk and concern on the part of the state, the producer parties have committed that if asked by the state, they will, and it's quoted here specifically from the HOA, negotiate separately with the state in good faith to enter into an agreement with the state regarding the purchase or other disposition of a portion of the LNG. I can't actually tell you how many antitrust attorneys were involved in crafting those specific words, but you know, I'm pretty sure there was an hourly rate combined that probably eclipsed tens of thousands of dollars. It's a very delicate area of law, both in this country and in the countries that we hope to be selling this LNG into, and need to be very careful not to in any way collude or trip over the lines and laws that exist on both sides of the border. What this really means in layman's terms is that we're going to be able to leverage the marketing expertise and the specific terms that the producer parties use when they sell their LNG to sell our LNG. And it, we think, is very likely that this approach will protect us in at least that pricing component of the RAK arrangement that Black & Veatch flagged for us in that 2013 study. And
Representative Herron.
Thank you. Commissioner, on that point, in this negotiations, what you call the delicate balance, is it literally we're stating that we're not going to be shortchanged? I mean, the rate we sell is, in comparison to our partners, will be nearly identical?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, that is the intent going forward here. We did have initial conversations with each of the parties to investigate this a little bit. And as part of the process that will unfold during the pre-feed phase, we will further those conversations into more specific agreements that would be part of the package coming back to the body in 2015.
So, Mr. Chairman, so on that, so the three individual parties, we can negotiate separately with each one. And it, so the state has the unique position of knowing what the other two are negotiating with you, too. I mean, you understand where I'm going with that question.
Mr.
Through or the not chair, a question, more of a comment.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I'm going to be spending a fair amount of time with antitrust counsel as well to make sure that I don't do anything that would
sure
expose the state to any sort of antitrust jeopardy. But, yes, we're going to be able to see what those opportunities are with each of those companies. We'll also have the opportunity to independently market our LNG. There may, in fact, be good reason for the state to independently market some volume of our LNG product.
Now, Mr. Chair, last question. So is this opportunity unique to the state, or do the other partners have that same? They can negotiate with another partner independent of the state?
Through the chair, Representative Herron.
Or is this just for us?
I think that this is a specific provision that we needed to be comfortable with the RAK approach. How they go about marketing their respective quantities and volumes of LNG is left to each of them. I am familiar with a method of marketing called joint marketing, where all of the sponsors of a project come together and form a new marketing company to market the total output of a project. And those organizations, when set up, have to be hived off, separated from the parent entities or sponsor entities. And that sort of approach, that joint marketing approach, is something that is not universally used, but has been used by these companies in other projects in other parts of the world.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Not to get too deep in the weeds, Joe, what might be disposition, Article Key Provision 3, agreement of the state regarding the purchase or other disposition of a portion of the LNG, what might be an other disposition? Just barter? Or?
So, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the an outright purchase would be a situation where they just flat out buy our LNG at the outlet of the plant and take it from there. Another disposition would be basically anything else. It could be that we sign on as a co-party in an individual sale agreement that they have with one of the entities, in which case we would in essence be marketing side by side, something like that. I can tell you that in our conversations with each of the three companies, we heard three different approaches to solving this particular problem. And directionally, all very similar, but as to the details, there were some differences. And I think you have much to look forward to in learning about portfolios of contracts and how those things are managed and the differences between the different companies.
Joe, are we going to be marketing the gas on a BTU basis or on a volume basis?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, every SPA is a unique deal. And so the big broad category or metric for the sale of LNG is measured in, you know, tons per annum.
What will we be taxing on, though?
The contract itself, though, very likely is going to have heat content requirements, right? And so the gas that is produced off of the slope and then converted into LNG is going to have a particular range of heat that will be in the LNG, and that will help in the marketing of the product itself. As far as the tax aspect goes, we are going to be taking a gross volume approach. So whatever the heat content is, we'll be getting a gross volume approach as opposed to something that's going to vary volumetrically depending on the heat.
So that would be similar to the way that it's been handled out of Nikuski to Japan for 42 years?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I have to confess I'm not that familiar with the production taxing aspects of that operation. I'm more familiar with the royalty aspects, which is not very sophisticated. We do a calculation on the JCC price and take a percentage of that.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. This is a learning opportunity, too. So, Joe, so the tax will be on gross volume, 10.5 or whatever you envision. The contracts will be based on heat value or BTU value. This allows me the chance to illuminate what a balancing agreement might be. If the expectation was there was a certain BTU value in the gas, and after a year's time, it was determined it was varying from the contract, would that be what a balancing agreement would be set up to do, just to make good? Or is that a poor understanding of what a balancing agreement is?
Through the chair, Rep. Sadler, that potentially could be an aspect of a balancing agreement, but ultimately what we're seeking is to solve the volume issue and in those balancing agreements. And basically, through a series of debits and credits to those working balances over time, make sure that everybody, you know, gets their due, and that nobody overproduces or underproduces from their respective share. Those agreements can have a variety of mechanisms, features, commercial solutions to an imbalance that may be made up in a number of ways, including with cash. So I think the thing that we're going to want to pay really close attention to is the offtake agreement itself specifying the heat content of the gas that's coming off.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're pretty casual here.
Commissioner Balash, when I think of royalty in kind, I think of the state on an accounting piece of paper holding the equivalent of a tank filled with natural gas. And the scuttlebutt, and both in the hallways and in much of what I've read, is that the prohibition, the constitutional restriction on disallowing, that's two negatives, but future legislatures from changing the gross production tax rate would not apply if we take it in kind, and that's my mental image of this tank in the sky, but it would apply if we took it as cash. And I will tell you that if I'm wrong about that, you have some dispelling to do, because I probably am not the only one. My first question is, why is that different? Why is the taking it in kind? And the reason is, I'm very intrigued by House Bill 277. Holding my cards somewhat close, but I'm very intrigued by it. However, I could envision my constituents saying, Andy, you have, not that I have the power to, but you have incidentally or deliberately tied the hands of the 29th, 30th, 31st legislatures. What is your, and it may be the AG should answer that, and maybe not, I don't know. What is your response to that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you're touching on a point that is critical to the success of this project, and that is how any of the parties, including Commissioner Rodell and I, can, in our fiduciary roles, enter into the kinds of contracts that are necessary for a project like this to go forward. And in this construct, we have every bit as much interest in the durability of these terms as the other parties. Because if we're going to be taking out long-term financing, long-term capacity, and exposing ourselves to long-term sales of LNG, we're going to want to be able to count on things occurring as we're expecting. Now, when you introduce all of this to a democratic body and a democratic form of government, representative government, you have to be able to survive the constitutional question you're describing. And simply taking in kind in and of itself isn't the magic key here, but the crossover between multiple agreements here is going to provide avenues of opportunity for us to solve this durability problem and challenge for us and for them. Because if you imagine your tank that you described, mm-hmm. if you're going to have that tank filled up and delivered five times a day for 25 years, you want to be sure that that tank gets filled five times a day and that you're going to receive enough gas, but not too much gas, right? Mm-hmm. So that you can meet your obligations to your buyers. In the future, if all of this unfolds a particular way, you can surmise that if a future legislature were to change taxes, our agreements are going to have to contemplate that and say, okay, if that happens, here's what else happens. Here's how our agreements between us change. And in order to get to yes on the agreements in the first place, everybody's going to have to be comfortable with how those specific mechanisms work. And, you know, in a very simplified way, let's just say the state's number is 20%, and we go about and secure 20% of the infrastructure capacity and so forth. And all of a sudden, 15 years from now, all of our replacements think it's a good idea to change our number from 20 to 30. Well, now we're going to have 50% more volume on our hands. What are we going to do with it? We're going to have to go find capacity. Well, who's got capacity? The people we just raised taxes on. How's that going to work? Well, they're probably going to charge us. How much? Probably about as much as we just took out of their pocket. So, you know, is that exactly how this is all going to fit together? You know, that's part of what we're going to find out in the next 2 years.
Thanks.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. So, to kind of for the record, to put a fine point on it, you're saying that there certainly is a constitutional obligation that must be preserved in any future legislature to have the right to change taxes. What you envision is a network of agreements that would dampen out the effect of any future change to end up in the end, if not nullifying, minimizing it to the point where all the parties are still in agreement. It's okay. Is that a fair assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I wouldn't describe it as nullifying.
Okay.
I would rather describe it as understanding consequences. That, you know, when we change our taxes, regardless of which tax we're talking about, there is a consequence. And in this case, it's going to be real specific what those consequences are and how that affects other agreements that we may care very much about. Exactly how many places we'll have to work with in the overall complex and network of contracts, you know, we'll be exploring that.
Chair Olson, I just wanted to add to that, and I guess I should put myself on the record since I haven't spoken yet today. I'm Angela Rodell, the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue.
And I think what we're also looking at here is that these will be very specific and targeted contracts that are in place. They don't apply to all the gas and oil production across the entire state of Alaska. So there's opportunities for the state and future legislatures to take various actions as they do now and recognize distinctions between production in different areas, like we do between Cook Inlet and the North Slope. So I also just wanted to remind the committee that while these contracts may have consequences, the legislature will have an opportunity to look at a variety of tax plans in the future as they see fit.
Well, thank you. Back to you, Joe, I guess.
Okay. There's some other project enabling terms that are found in Articles 9 and 10. And this is one that's gotten some attention here, especially lately with our Conference of Mayors and Alaska Municipal League in town. And we think that utilization of a payment in lieu of tax system is going to serve not only the state, but also municipalities and the project sponsors very well if we are able to take advantage of that. And so we have committed to work in consultation with local governments to develop a system of payments in lieu of tax that will go into effect on operation of the pipeline. Preceding that, there will be impact payments provided to the affected communities as well. That is an undertaking that will begin if and only if this enabling legislation passes. We didn't really see a whole lot of need to engage the communities at this point in time, not knowing if we're actually going to be heading down the path. But clearly, it's something that's on the radar screens of our mayors, and we look forward to working with them in the months ahead.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And this may be a question for Angela. I understand the state does, this is exclusive of production tax, exclusive of corporate income tax. This is statewide or local, municipal, or borough property taxes. So right now, the current law is you would pay property taxes in cash to the municipalities or to the state. I'm not quite sure payment in lieu of property taxes, not quite sure what concept is envisioned here.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the idea is that rather than having a mill rate that resets every year based on valuation changes, or you have a flat mill rate and valuation changes, and therefore potential debates over the valuations, you know, Trans-Alaska Pipeline comes to mind. What you have in this stead is you have an agreement as to what the payment of property tax will be, and it's not based on a mill rate calculation against a valuation. And you come to an agreement as to how that payment is going to be calculated and what you take into account in that calculation, but it is just sort of a flat payment. And it also sort of goes to what sort of impact payments will go along before there's even improvements to valuation and property, but there's tremendous impact on infrastructure and communities as a result of all the work that's happening. So it's a negotiation.
And is that a follow-up? Is that a power that your department, I assume, currently, the administration currently has? Or is this power to negotiate a payment in lieu of taxes something that would be granted by the enabling legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, actually the answer to that is neither. We currently don't have the power to negotiate that, and we don't contemplate it in the enabling legislation in the bill that will come before you later, but rather it is something that we want to work with the municipalities and other local governments as to what that will look like and come back to you with a comprehensive property tax proposal next year.
2015.
Exactly.
Okay, good. Thank you.
But will the initial structure be set for the life of the project, or how long?
Representative Olson, I don't believe we I don't think we know what the structure will look like, because I think we're going to want to take into account the various stages of the project and what's happening, what the impacts are at various stages, and when things, when we expect revenues to start flowing, when the valuations will take effect, and when people can expect to receive property taxes off that project, because it'll be generating revenue and become a source of, you know, payment for those property taxes. So I think at this point we don't know, but we want to put together a framework. And I think that, as you've heard with a number of pieces of this project, is that we're going to be coming to you every single year between now and probably by the time we turn on the gas flow to this, adjusting and asking for amendments and informing as to what the contracts look like.
The reason I'm curious is because it's my understanding that the TAPS balancing that's done every 5 or 10 years is typically done in D.C. by the, I think primarily by the RCA and by FERC.
Through the, Mr. Chairman, I think you might be referring to the tariff setting that goes on, or maybe the quality bank. Those are things that the FERC and RCA deal with.
No, so I believe it's the agreement on the valuation of the pipeline and then the recalculation of the paid taxes.
Mr. Chair,
whether they're under or over, but
Mr. Chairman, I believe that some of those valuation determinations factor into the full and fair value that is assessed, full and true value that is assessed by the Department of Revenue. How those feed off of one another or interrelate, I'm not entirely familiar.
Representative Olson, I'm not sure either at this point, but I will look into it and get back to you with
the
question.
Yeah, the only reason I bring it up is I believe 2 years ago that pretty much the entire RCA was back in D.C. for at least 4 or 5 months on the issue. And we had a difficult time. We had some issues that were before them from a legislative standpoint, and everybody was in D.C.
Mr. Chairman, that, I'm familiar with that, and that was a rate-making trial that FERC and the RCA conducted jointly.
Thank you. It was all Chinese to me. I knew we had a lot of people back there and a lot of high-powered talent that was tied up, and I think it was probably because there was a lot of money on the table for everybody involved.
And, Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct, and it's because so much money is involved that we fight over those things, and it's because we ship our oil on their pipe. And that's one of the things that I think we're actually going to see as a net benefit in this construct is we're going to be shipping on our own share of the infrastructure, and those kinds of disputes and protracted trials and adjudications are hopefully going to be a thing of the past.
If you pull that off, I'll be real impressed. In fact, quite frankly, I'm impressed that we've gone as far as we have on this one. I think there are a lot of people that are looking at it and thinking that, you know, we might have something. But that's my personal feeling, and probably the wrong place to voice it on record.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to follow that comment, I mean,
Representative Heron,
literally, it's real money,
yeah,
for both the project and the product that we're going to sell.
So, you know, the key provisions in these two articles 9 and 10 touched on the provision for PILTS, definitely calling out the need for the project enabling contracts that will allow each of the parties to undertake the kinds of investments or obligations that will be necessary for this to all come together and move forward. There is an expression of general support from the state in this agreement for the development of the necessary infrastructure and permitting. And then finally, calling out the need for a healthy long-term oil business here in Alaska to support this project. Something that when we get to talking about the overall economics of this that we will discuss is right now we've got the economics of gas relying on oil to carry the costs of operating Prudhoe and Point Thompson. And so we've got to have a healthy enough oil business to support those costs. Otherwise, the gas revenue has to support those costs, and we start to get into trouble. So,
Joe, this is probably a good place to stop and take a few questions. We've most of us are going to another meeting at 5, but this looks like a good place to break for you for
Commissioner. I think this last slide is the last one on the heads of agreement, and then we'd be in a natural stopping point for the MOU, and you can bring Commissioner Riddell back.
We'd want you to.
I think it's in everybody's best interest that we continue these meetings so we don't have it all lumped up.
Absolutely.
The last week of session.
Getting a jump on things is great in my book. So.
And I appreciate you both taking the time to come and join us today.
So the final slide on the heads of agreement is Article 11. And this is where we have identified some pretty important things for the men and women who are going to be working on this project. And this particular article provides guidance on the hiring of Alaska residents, the contracting with Alaska businesses, the participation of DLWD in providing training for the occupations that are going to be needed to support the project. And finally, a commitment by the project sponsors to negotiate in good faith project labor agreements for the project itself. And so you've got a couple of key numbers here on the right-hand side of the slide. The estimated total cost of the project, $45 to $65 billion. And the number of jobs associated with all of this are frankly staggering. At peak construction, we're going to see somewhere on the order of 15,000 jobs in Alaska as a result of this. And once we are into operation, we're going to see about 1,000 long-term jobs. Mr. Chairman, I think your community is going to benefit from very many of those with the operation of the LNG plant and associated marine terminal and vessels. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about the heads of agreement, and we look forward to talking further about the MOU and what this all means in terms of dollars and cents leading up to FID.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bullet, commit to negotiating good faith project labor agreements, this is unfortunately not an area of the law that I pursued. I wish I had in some respects. But what I'm told by other people I respect all sorts of people in this building, but different groups of people I respect, tell me that the language commit to negotiating good faith is not strong enough. And there was an amendment, it was either 17 or 18, it's on my desk, that made its way into AGEA, and it is signed by a huge number of previous members of the State House of both parties. And I believe that that language didn't make its way into House Bill 277. Do you think there is something, do you think I'm right, if you know? And is there something we can do to enhance that language and toughen it up?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think you might have a couple of pieces of that history mm-hmm. wrong. Okay. And I'd be happy to sit down and go through the...
It's the first time. I'm 49. I've never heard that before.
Well, I'll try to make it up to you before my confirmation vote. the effort here, both in the original AGEA statute and what we've done here in the HOA, is try to recognize that a project labor agreement is something that could be a very, very helpful tool to ensure that the project's labor is not interrupted. That one of the things that could help cause a cost overrun as if we had a work stoppage. And so there are certain benefits to having a PLA. However, if we were to somehow obligate the project sponsors to sign a PLA, then there really wouldn't be a whole lot of room to negotiate. Basically, they would be over a barrel and have to agree to whatever terms got laid down in front of them. And so this concept of negotiating in good faith is really what we are targeting is to make sure that that negotiation happens, to make sure that that opportunity is fully explored by the relevant parties, and not put our thumbs on the scale to determine the outcome of those negotiations. So I'm certain that there are people who would like us to not just put a thumb but a whole hand on the scale, and probably on both sides of that debate. But we're trying to keep things in an even fashion here. And when we do get to the legislation, you'll find that we don't have the specific terms of this provision or many of the other provisions contained in the legislation itself. Part of the reason for that is we're seeking a general law, and with general authorities for Commissioner Rodell and myself to exercise, or for our replacements to exercise if this all falls apart. And what we're trying to avoid is putting in a whole lot of detail and minutia into the underlying statute itself. But the heads of agreement is a guidance document. It is what we are going to use and rely on to negotiate the agreements that will come back to the bodies in 15, and you'll have it as a measuring stick. Did we or didn't we bring to the legislature an agreement that contains a provision such as this?
Okay. I guess if I could just make one comment.
Certainly.
In order to make the biggest tent you can make, there are going to be colleagues who even at this early stage are going to be looking for that. Thanks.
Just one last comment. I remember that amendment, but I don't think it was a huge number of people because there's only basically two numbers that count in the building, 21 and 11. I don't believe it had 21 signatures on that particular amendment.
Okay. I'll find it.
I should have passed it if it had 21 and 11. But having said that, I'd like to thank both the commissioners for showing up, and I think you had some staff here for a while.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll make our way up to Senate Finance now.
Oh, well. Good luck. And we'll see you again soon, and I think we'll be contacting you on scene when we can finish it up. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah. And adjourned to 5:00.